China slams the United States for holding talks with a Taiwanese president as tensions remain high between the two economic powers. Taiwan's capital goes under heavy security days ahead of the presidential inauguration after a deadly attack on Congress by Trump supporters. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has exceeded 23 million. 384,000 Americans have died of the disease. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with this China-U.S. thing, the country has slammed Washington for holding virtual talks with the Taiwanese president, and this is while tensions remain high between the two economic powers.
The Chinese side firmly opposes any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan. The words and deeds of Kelly Craft seriously interfere with China's internal affairs, gravely violate the One China principle and the provisions of the three China-U.S. joint communiques, and gravely violate the U.S. political commitment on the Taiwan question. China is firmly opposed to that.
Beijing called on Washington to abide by the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. China says it will continue to take all necessary measures to resolutely safeguard its sovereignty and security interests. It also warned that some U.S. politicians will inevitably pay a heavy price for the wrong statements and actions. Well, and that after the U.S. ambassador's visit to the territory was canceled during the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. China regards Taiwan to be part of its territory and is strongly opposed to increased U.S. support for it. From Hong Kong, I'm now joined by Fabrizio Goldoni, who's an analyst and commentator. Good to have you with us, Fabrizio. So what's happening? We have only a few days left, and we have Mr. Pompeo especially and other people in the U.S., Mr. Trump's administration, still spewing their poison, and this U.S.-China thing going on over Taiwan. And, of course, you know, there's a host of other issues.
Yes. I mean, it's quite, difficult to understand why, this moment in this period where basically we are at the transition of the power in the United States, must happen this kind of, provocation. No? Let's put it this way. Uh-huh. Because I say this one because if we talk about Kelly Craft, Kelly Craft is basically a act as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Basically, if we consider the potential visit of Kelly Craft to Taiwan, we have to see that his visit, the last one, was in the 1979. So, it was something that is already closed, this kind of relationship, diplomatic activities. It's something that already has been closed a long time ago. So it seems, I used before a term provocation to organize this delegation visit to Taiwan that was supposed to stay there for 3 days. Is something that leave many people a little bit concerned. Yeah.
Yeah, Fabrizio, what would you advise that the right measure would be for the Chinese, given the fact that these, as you know, this is the final days of the Trump administration, so how seriously should they take this issue? Should they actually making reactions or wait for this transition to happen and maybe there will be a change?
of course, they have to make some reaction. And they have to keep the same stand, the same position that they have to kept in the past, okay? Because we assume that the new president will go back to normal, let's put it this way. But it's an assumption for us. We don't know yet what is going on. So I don't think is an idea to be flexible in this moment.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Fabrizio Goldoni, analyst and commentator, who joined me from Hong Kong. Authorities in the United States are beefing up security in the capital, Washington, D.C., ahead of the January 20th inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will remain on high alert in the city. The Pentagon announced that these forces are also authorized to carry weapons and make arrests, citing public safety as their priority. A number of public areas and monuments will be closed to the people until after the inauguration. Security measures come amid fears of violent protests during the ceremony. Last week, the Congress building was breached by supporters of President Trump, and five people were killed as a result. The House of Representatives already impeached Trump over charges of inciting insurrection on the Capitol.
In a vote which fell almost totally along party lines, Donald Trump has become the first United States president to be impeached twice. Before Bill Clinton in 1998, there was only one other impeachment ever, reflecting how highly polarized the nation has become. The impeachment appears totally symbolic. A trial in the Senate and a two-thirds vote in favor is needed to actually convict and expel Trump. The Senate will not meet until January 19th, and Joe Biden will be inaugurated as president on January 20th.
Trump will be out of the office in 7 days. I mean, you know, like, I think that I understand and I'm sympathetic to people who want him out earlier. But I just don't think that it's the a priority of anybody who wants to make sure that this doesn't continue. And the goal should be to cut across the sympathies for these right-wing actions.
Just 1 week earlier, the entire world was shocked after a protest burst into the Capitol building, the home of America's parliament, stopping the counting of the Electoral College's disputed presidential votes. Anger, accusations, despair, and emotional outbursts immediately swept the nation and may not lessen even after impeachment. Some top media have compared the events, which occurred on the date 1-6, to 9-11. The Democrat-dominated House of Representatives successfully charged Trump with incitement to insurrection so quickly that many wonder if they have set a dangerous precedent of a so-called snap impeachment. Worries are widespread that the only practical result of the historic impeachment is even more division in a nation already racked by the coronavirus, racial strife, police brutality, years of tremendous cultural disunity, and economic catastrophe.
I think that impeachment is a good side dish, but it should not be the focus of anybody who considers themselves to be on the left. I understand why the center might do that. Why neoliberals might do it, but Keynesian, you know, if you will, actions such as the $2,000, universal health care, that these things need to be put forth to undermine the growth of the right, the growing right, which I don't think impeachment is going to address.
The controversial decision of the House of Representatives came after the FBI warned that armed anti-inauguration protests are expected across all 50 state capitals starting on January 16th and ending on Inauguration Day at the earliest. The United States will remain in a historic state of tension and animosity until then, and maybe even long after. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The author and commentator John Stepling says that the recent chaos in the United States has pushed the country on the verge of a police state.
It's a dangerous moment because we're seeing a huge number of people in the liberal press, the sort of pseudo-left press, cheerleading what are really repressive policies and dangerous anti-democratic policies. The lockdown themselves are anti-democratic. There's been no debate, no referendum, nothing of that sort in regard to this at all. So we're seeing increasingly a government by decree and a populace, divided populace indeed, but certainly a huge number of people asking for very repressive legislation, and we're seeing a press, a media that is extraordinarily biased.
The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S. has exceeded 23 million, data tracked by Johns Hopkins University shows. 384,000 Americans have succumbed to the disease. The U.S., which has already started the vaccination campaign, remains the worst-hit nation, the world's highest case load and death toll, and the situation keeps worsening. The surge in the death toll has overwhelmed local hospitals as well as funeral homes. A team of international scientists led by the World Health Organization has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to start a probe into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Peter Ben Mbarak, leader of the team, says that they will initially focus on advancing several studies and site visits. He, however, says that the investigation will take a long time. The arrival of WHO experts coincides with China's announcements of its first COVID-related fatality in 8 months. The country has also recorded its highest daily cases in more than 5 months. China is grappling with a resurgence of the coronavirus amid strict lockdowns. Nearly 88,000 infections reported and 4,600 related deaths. And this is since the emergence of the virus in late 2019. Stephen Ribe says that the WHO investigation into COVID-19 origins in China will be highly politicized.
The U.S. under Trump, for example, has blamed China for not being transparent enough at the beginning of this pandemic and not doing enough to warn the rest of the world, which is a bit rich coming from Trump, who downplayed the threat right at the beginning. Of course, it's disappointing. This mission has been a long time coming. It was held up by China, and the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has said he actually criticized China. He said he was disappointed that they weren't given clearance to arrive earlier. I think it's because China's scared of this blame game, that the whole thing is going to be used as an exercise to blame China. It must be stressed that blame is going to do no good whatsoever. Everybody is hoping that the WHO scientists will be able to interview, be able to research and find out where this virus came from in order to save the world from a future epidemic, maybe something which is much worse than this one.
The Turkish Defense Minister says Ankara won't turn back on its deal for Russian S-400 missile systems, despite opposition from the U.S. Hulusi Akar says that annulling the contract on the S-400 import would be quite problematic. He expressed hope, however, that a dispute with the U.S. on the issue could be resolved through dialogue. He urged Washington to distance itself from threatening language such as sanctions. Washington slapped sanctions on Ankara last month following its acquisition of the S-400 system. The U.S. says that the Russian missile systems pose a threat to its F-35 fighter jets and to NATO's broader defense systems. Turkey rejects the allegations and says that S-400s will not be integrated into NATO. A political commentator, Hatem Yavuz, says that Turkey is trying to become militarily independent of the U.S. by purchasing S-400 missile system from Russia, as well as developing its own defense technology.
Turkey have to weigh its balance and said, hey, if the Americans are going to give out thousands of truckloads of armory to their allies' enemy, which is the YPG, PKK, whatever you want to call those alphabets, what's going to happen in the next few years if they attack us? So if we used an American system now, today, it won't probably work on the Turkish soil. So for that reason, Turkey had to be more independent and receive information technology transfer from the Russians under the S-400 program. So it's not just the machinery itself of the $2.4 billion purchase, it's the technology transfer. Turkey has been staunch to develop its own systems integrated with its S-400 together, not a NATO ally system. And this will go on. This will go on for the next term of presidency of Biden, arguing don't set up the S-400s. Well, Turkey has set up the S-400s. Like it or not, Turkey has to take and control its own security and its own interest.
The Iranian Navy is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in the Sea of Oman. Iranian surface combat units, subsurface and Navy forces, and aerial units are practicing battles with mock enemy forces, performing joint operations against any possible military scenario. Surface-to-surface cruise missiles and torpedoes will be fired from domestically developed submarines during the exercises. Unmanned aerial operations and electronic warfare tactics will be exercised as well. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparedness and military prowess of the Iranian armed forces in the strategic southern waters.
Iran's Navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's Navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the Army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel, unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate, called Zereh or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces. The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills. With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills. Trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending, and new borrowings set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. We now present you an article written jointly by Alexander Villegas and Anthony Fayola and Leslie Roughton. The piece is titled, As Spending Climbs and Revenue Falls, Coronavirus Forces a Global Reckoning. The article has been taken from the Washington Post. Costa Rica built Latin America's model society, enacting universal health care and spending its way to one of the Western Hemisphere's highest literacy rates. But now, it's reeling from financially crushing side effects of the coronavirus, as cratering revenues and crisis spending forces a reckoning over a massive pile of government debt. The coronavirus pandemic is hurtling heavily leveraged nations into an economic danger zone, threatening to bankrupt the worst affected. Costa Rica, a country known for ziplining tourists and American retirees, is scrambling to stave off a full-blown debt crisis, imposing emergency cuts and proposing harsher measures that touched off rare violent protests last autumn. To keep the lights on, a progressive, eco-friendly nation is weighing desperate solutions, including open-pit gold mining, even oceanic fracking. Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills, trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending and new borrowing set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs, is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. Analysts call it a debt tsunami. National accounts are sinking into the red at a record level. According to the Institute of International Finance, by the end of 2020, total government debt worldwide was projected to soar by $9 trillion and top 103% of global gross domestic product or GDP, a historic jump of more than 10 percentage points in just 1 year. Countries have maxed out their figurative credit cards to buy medical equipment, set up field hospitals, deployed healthcare workers and sourced vaccines, even as pandemic-related recessions have caused tax revenues to plunge and aid for the unemployed to spike. Countries that rely on tourism, which has ground to a virtual halt, or commodities like oil that have sunk in price, have felt the sting most keenly. The United States itself has run up debt at a pace not seen since the Second World War, but the world's wealthy nations are supposedly better able to cope with the growing debt than their poorer counterparts. Angola, for example, effectively shut out of global markets, is racing to strike a deal with the Chinese, but even that might not be enough to prevent a painful debt crisis. Sri Lanka, locked in recession, needs to make $4 billion in debt payments this year, with only $6 billion in the bank. Brazil's debt, worsened by a yawning budget deficit, has surged to a crippling 95% of the gross domestic product GDP, raising alarm over the medium-term ability of the Latin American giant to stay afloat. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have sought to aid the most vulnerable countries, and the world's wealthiest nations endorsed a plan in October to extend the suspension of debt payments owed to them by the poorest countries. In November, those nations additionally agreed to jointly work towards some form of debt relief for the poorest nations that seek it from them, and also encourage private lenders to follow suit. But analysts say that may not be enough. According to the International Monetary Fund, 38 low-income countries are either in debt distress or at high risk of falling into it. Unless private creditors and wealthy nations set up and agree to concessions or outright debt forgiveness, the pandemic's fiscal shock could hurl some of those, as well as highly leveraged middle-income countries such as Costa Rica, towards catastrophic national bankruptcies. analysts argue that the need for stimulus to keep economies running during this historically challenging period still outweighs the need to balance budgets. Even the International Monetary Fund, the global guardian of fiscal rectitude, is telling countries that now is not the time to scrimp, lest they jeopardize still fragile economic recoveries. Yet, even if a repeat of the cascading financial crises seen in Latin America and Asia in the 1980s and 1990s is avoided, the debt surge threatens to linger as a millstone around the necks of nations for years. It will compromise their ability to fight the first global increase in extreme poverty since the 1990s, and to invest in infrastructure projects, such as education and innovation, down the line. Zambia, once a shining example of Africa's economic renaissance, is now the ghost of crisis future for debt-burdened countries slammed by the coronavirus pandemic. The sub-Saharan African nation fell into default in November, a result of its high reliance on foreign debt, a pandemic blow to the price of copper, its main commodity, and one of its worst droughts in 40 years. The country is now printing money to survive, forcing a devaluation of its currency, kwacha, and creating spiraling inflation that's spreading misery at the worst possible time. At the government's cancer disease hospital in Lusaka, the capital of Zambia, doctors say the price of imported drug treatments have doubled. According to a household survey in July, a third of the country's workers have lost their wages, 39% were skipping a meal, and 67% are worried about not having enough food to eat. Sakala Zulu, a 26-year-old teacher from eastern Zambia, said staple food such as eggs and sugar now cost 60% more than just 3 months ago, making it harder to feed his six children. The cost of transport for the 12-mile commute to and from work has risen by 20%. Sakala Zulu said, "Right now, I feel there is no part of my life not affected." Zambia is seeking to restructure its debt, but private creditors have shown little willingness to budge. A move to renegotiate substantial loans from China has been cloaked in secrecy. As things stand, more than half of the government's spending this year is earmarked for servicing debt alone, leaving little for social programs and spending on healthcare and education. Ishmael Zulu of the advocacy group Cuts International said, "What you see now on the ground is reduced spending on key social sectors," he added. "With the high levels of poverty in Zambia, there are many people that are heavily reliant on government programs. These programs are suffering at the cost of increased debt levels. Hospitals that are in small districts and the far-flung areas of the country are suffering at the cost of increased debt servicing." Half a world away, Costa Rica is scrambling to avoid a similar fate. When the pandemic hit, tourism, the country's economic lifeblood, dried up and unemployment skyrocketed to more than 24%, draining state coffers of healthcare contributions just as the Costa Rican government was struggling to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. A tax break for hard-hit businesses and financial aid to out-of-work Costa Ricans dug the fiscal hole deeper. The ensuing cash crunch forced hard decisions for the government, including emergency cuts. At El Jardin Elementary School in northern Costa Rica, Principal Elizabeth Mejia says the operating budget was slashed in half. Teachers are buying their own printers, ink cartridges, and paper to distribute assignments to students. School Principal Elizabeth Mejia said she's been told by the government to hold fundraisers to cover maintenance costs. "They tell us that if we need to fix something, that we should go and sell our assets." In the years after the Great Recession of 2008, Costa Rica ran up deficits and debt to sustain expansive state payrolls and progressive policies. 2 years ago, the government attempted what economists describe as a fiscal band-aid. a new value-added tax, VAT, and limits on salary increases for state workers. Those measures paled in comparison with proposal last year when the government of President Carlos Alvarado Quesada, seeking to boost its bid for a $1.75 billion IMF bailout, sought broad tax increases in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Protesters hit the streets of Costa Rica, blocking intersections nationwide, clashing with police officers and slowing commerce in a country that had only recently come out of lockdown. Gerardo Zuniaga, an activist who joined the protests with a mask on his face, said, "People don't have money to pay their debts. Businesses don't have money to pay for supplies, their employees, their permits, and all the social contributions." Gerardo Zuniaga said, "We understand that there has to be some agreement with the International Monetary Fund, but what we don't agree with are items where the most vulnerable people are harmed." The Costa Rican government backed off that proposal and is now in talks with the opposition, unions, civic activists, and industrial groups to find a more palatable solution. But to avoid a painful default like the one the country suffered in 1981, when runaway inflation and spikes in poverty sparked a lost decade, something's got to give. With tourism not expected to recover fully for many years, politicians and businesses are pushing sources of revenue that run afoul of Costa Rica's renowned environmentalism. They include open-pit gold mining, effectively an ecological trade-off for what supporters estimate would be 6,500 direct and indirect jobs and a $9.52 billion jolt for the economy. In August, lawmakers pushed another controversial option, opening Costa Rica lands and shorelines to fracking and oil drilling. Costa Rican lawmaker Patricia Villegas said during a congressional debate, "Our marine territory is 10 times larger than our landmass, and we know little about its riches," she added. "We have sources of energy that we exploit, like hydroelectric energy, wind energy, geothermal, and solar, but we haven't wanted to discuss the possibility of taking advantage of gas and oil. Costa Rica is sitting on a gold mine." In a country that pledged to rely entirely on renewable energy sources by 2030, the debt debate is pitting the country's economic future against cherished environmental ideals and goals. Activists and the government say any boost in oil and natural gas exploration runs counter to everything the country has worked for. They say the nation must find other ways. Eliane Villegas, Costa Rica's finance minister, said, "We've launched a decarbonization plan to the world, and those things are fundamental to us as a nation, not just cosmetic." He added, "I find those solutions to be very distant from the essence of being a Costa Rican."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from a series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio and our discussion concerning the doubts or misconceptions on this very important topic. For this cause, we have invited Islamic researcher Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me. I was born in 1981 and I joined the Hausa Seminary of Qom in 1994, so it's about 25 years that I'm studying the Hausa Seminary of Qom. And beside fiqh and usul, or jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence, I have studied logic, Arabic literature and grammar, Islamic philosophy, and more importantly, Islamic theology. I also have my BA in Islamic Theology from Imam Khomeini Institute for Education and Research in Qom. And then I continued my education on monotheistic religions. I mean, I had my MA in this field from the University of Religions and Islamic Denominations. And I have my PhD in Shia Theology from University of Tehran. My PhD was about an analysis of the viewpoint of one of the false claimants with regards to the knowledge of the Imam.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have already been talking about the doubts that were asked and were posed by the followers of fake believers or like fake claimers on Mahdawi or Mahdism, namely a person in Basra in Iraq. And now from today and from now on, inshallah, we shall talk about some doubts and misconceptions posed through a Wahhabi approach on Shiaism. Namely, the first question that we want to ask from the respected guest speaker of the show. Sheikhuna, it is sad, and definitely all the Shias deny this claim, that Shias at the time of the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, contemporary to the life of Imam Hassan al-Askari, and let's say the demise and martyrdom of Imam Hassan al-Askari, and also the birth of Imam al-Zaman and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, deny the birth of Imam. Is it true or not? Is this claim a valid claim to believe or not? If I'm asked, as the follower of Ahlul Bayt, all the people would deny the same doubt, but I want to see what is the scholarly answer to this question.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. As you know, recently, I mean, in the recent decades, many of the Shia books have been translated into English languages, and also they have been available through some softwares, and many people, they have access to them. Now, unfortunately, in some cases, especially the Wahhabis, who are against the Shia beliefs, they have referred to some of the books of the Shia and they have ignored the others. And referring to some of the points in these books, they have brought about some doubts against Shia beliefs and in our case against Mahdawiya. So, as you mentioned, one of these Wahhabi scholars, recently he has written a book. He has analyzed the viewpoints of Shia school of thought. When it comes to the situation of the Shia after the demise of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, he says the following. So I try to mention all his claims so that we have a good understanding of his claims.
Thank you.
He says that the state of the Shia after the demise of Imam Askari alayhi salam should be taken into consideration because it has a very close connection to the emergence of the concept of occultation or ghiba. He says that after the demise of Hassan al-Askari, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, in the year 260, there was no successor for him, and the Shia did not see any child for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. And then he says that the Shia books have confessed to this fact. And that is why he claimed that the Shia, they became astonished somehow, because always they believed in a living Imam. And right now, after the demise of Imam Askar alayhi salam, they saw that there is no successor. And they believed that the earth could not be without a divine proof, without Hujjah. So many of them were in this situation of astonishment, and that is why they were divided into different groups. Now he quotes two Shia scholars. One of them is Nobakhti and the other is Qummi. And he says that according to Nobakhti, after the demise of Imam Askari al-Islam, Shia were divided into 14 groups. And according to Qummi, they were divided into 15 groups. Mm-hmm. So he says that this is the viewpoint of the Shia scholars.
True.
Which shows us that not all the Shia believe in the concept of Mahdism. And then he continues and says that even after these two scholars, there were more divisions. And according to another Shia book, they were divided into 20 groups. And maybe even more than that after it. So somehow, first of all, he has two claims. This author, he claims that, first of all, most of the Shia denied the existence of a successor for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam and a child for him.
Yeah.
And second of all, the concept of Imam Mahdi, who is in occultation, was forged by some Shia scholars to help these poor Shia. You see, the Shia did not find any Imam, so the Shia scholars, they brought about and forged that there is an Imam, but he's hidden, he is in occultation, so that they could answer the doubts of the Shia. So these are two claims mentioned by this Wahhabi scholar. Now we have...
Actually, the second is the continuation of the first.
Yes.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one my heart is to meet you.
First of all, the point is that when we refer to the Shia books, we read that the great majority of the Shia at the time of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam and after his martyrdom, they believed in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam when we refer to the books. So to claim that most of the Shia, they did not believe in a child for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam is against the books of history and the collections of hadith. Now, what matters here is that the claim of 14 sects or 15 sects after the demise of and martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. It is true that Nobakhti, one of the Shia scholars, has mentioned that. It is true, we are not denying that. But first of all, you cannot find it in the other Shia books. I mean, almost all the Shia scholars believe that after Waqifiyya, who believed in Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam as the last Imam, we do not have any other division among the Shia. Waqifiyya were the last division which was made among the Shia. So according to the Shia scholars, whoever believes in Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam believes in 12 Imams.
Very true. Just to ask a question regarding the last sentence that you said. You said that there is no other sect in Shiism except the Faqifiyah. So what do we have to do about Zaydiya and others who
believe? No, my point is that after Waqifiyah, there is no other division.
Yes, that's true. Thank
so
you.
Before Waqifiyah, yes, we have had Kaysaniyah, of course, who were disappeared. We have Zaydiya, who still today they exist. We
very
have
Ismailis.
Yeah. But the point is that, according to the Shia scholars, whoever believes in Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, he believes in 12 imams.
Very true.
Because from the time of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, there is no other division.
Very true.
Although there were some, new phenomena, like Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam being chosen as an imam when he was a child. But there is no division. And it was, according to many scholars, it was because of the efforts of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam in explaining the position of imamate, and so on and so forth. There are different reasons why there is no other division.
Very true.
But even if you accept the claim of Nobakhti, first of all, when these Wahhabi scholars claimed that the Shia were divided into 14 groups, we should not think that, okay, all of them were the same in quantity.
Yeah.
So Ithna Ashari, the 12 Shia, was one of these 14s, and the other 13s, they were also the same in number. No, it is very likely that the great majority of the Shia were the 12 Shia, and this is confirmed by other Shia books. And if there were any other division, they were very, very few in number, to the extent that they were not mentioned by most of the scholars.
Yeah.
So regarding this, for example, Sheikh al-Mufid, one of the greatest Shia scholars, he says that when Imam al-Askari alayhi salam passed away, the great majority of the Shia, they believed in the imamate of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. They believed in the fact that he was born to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and the fact that his name, like the name of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And the same has been mentioned by Sheikh al-Saduq in Kamal al-Din. He says that this is the argument of Sheikh al-Saduq. He says that regarding those who deny the existence of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, we ask him about the imamate of 11 imams before Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. If they believe in 11 imams, then he should believe in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam as well, because of the narrations of these 11 imams about the imamate of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So he wants to prove that the Shia who believe in 11 imams, including Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, they should also believe in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
Very true.
Now, also the Sunni scholars, many of Sunni scholars, although they do not believe in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam as the promised Mahdi, they believe that Mahdi will be born in future, but many Sunni scholars, they have approved that a son was born to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and the Shia believe that he is the promised Mahdi.
You said some of the Sunni brothers do not believe in Imam Mahdi as the promised Mahdi?
They do not believe in
The only difference, I think, is on about his birth, whether it happened or not.
Yeah, my point is that they do not believe in son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam as the promised
Mahdi.
Yeah,
that's something else, but they believe in the promised Mahdi.
I mean, Mahdism is a common belief of all the Muslims, and they believe that Mahdi will be born in future.
Very true.
My point is that although they do not believe in son of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam as Imam Mahdi, but they confess that a child was born
from progeny of Prophet of Islam.
Yeah. A child was born to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, this is one of the common questions. Some people question whether Mahdi is historical or not, meaning that whether Imam al-Askari alayhi salam had a child or not.
Sheikh, thank you very much. We are closing, actually, we are approaching the end of the show. Just in order to make our argument in brief, in two sentences, what is the gist of this discussion for today's show?
Of course, we need to continue, but the
Definitely.
First point is that the great majority of the Shia believed in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. This is against the claim of this Wahhabi scholar. And second of all, even the Sunni scholars, which I will discuss in details, they have mentioned that a son was born for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh, and you respected listeners for staying tuned with the last savior from IRM English Radio. Inshallah, we shall continue the discussion in the upcoming sessions. Join us then. Till then, I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjab bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. There's a tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam that on first glance, we as followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam might think that, oh no, we have a special station. But by actually looking deeper into the tradition, by actually looking deeper into the word that the Imam uses, and looking at other traditions of where this word is used, we'll come to realize that, no, we have a long way to go in order to attain that station that is mentioned in this tradition by Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. There are many lessons one can take from this tradition, and inshallah we will try and hopefully mention a few if time permits. So the tradition that is narrated from the Imam alayhi salam is this. The Imam, that's Imam Ali alayhi salam, is reported to have said, "The people of paradise will gaze upon the stations of our Shia." So now here we have two important aspects. One is that there will be people who are not Shia in paradise. This is something that this hadith is showing. If this hadith is correct, then it's like the thing is that there are people of paradise who look at our Shia. So there may be people who are not Shia who are in paradise according to the wording of this tradition. Second thing, the word Shia. And we'll come to that in a second. So the people of paradise will gaze upon the stations of our Shia, just as one of you gazes at the stars on the horizons of the sky. That you look at them and you look at them in, you know, perplexity and amazement. You look at them that they have such beauty, such glittering shininess. You know, you are taken aback by it. You're stunned by it, rather. But I want to go back to this tradition that the Imam says that the people of paradise will gaze upon the stations of our Shia. One of the things, my dear brothers and sisters, that we can take from this tradition as well is, what does it mean to be a Shia? We need to go to other traditions and which indicate that who a true Shia is. Is a true Shia just one who accepts the wilaya of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam? Is a true Shia just one who goes to the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and sheds some tears? Or is it more than that? Is it more than just being a follower or claiming to be a follower of the wilaya of Amir al-Mu'mineen? Or is it one who truly implements that wilaya and the teachings of those who we claim that we follow? This tradition of Amir al-Mu'mineen can have many explanations by going and looking at the other traditions that mention who a true Shia is. And hopefully, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us the ability to do that in future episodes, insha'Allah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.